Okay, so we're diving deep today into something pretty practical, and I think especially relevant for anyone who's ever, felt overwhelmed by the sheer volume of reading in law school.
Oh, yeah, tell me about it.
Right. So we got some listener feedback, and seems like a lot of you are interested in figuring out how to make these dense legal cases a little more digestible. It may be something you could even listen to on the go.
Definitely. And I think the idea of creating concise audio summaries is a brilliant one, especially for busy law students.
Exactly. So our deep dive today is going to focus on how to do just that. We've got some really interesting source material that basically lays out a blueprint for a hypothetical podcast called LexPlug, which would be specifically designed for law students.
Ooh, I like that name. LexPlug has a nice ring to it.
Right. And they use this classic torts case, Main v. Delaney Miller Auto Code, as like a case study for how to break down a case and turn it into an engaging audio summary.
Perfect example, too, because it hits on so many key tort concepts.
Absolutely. So our mission today is basically to become honorary LexPlug producers for a day. We're going to walk through this blueprint, see how they've structured it, what key points they emphasize, and how they suggest tailoring the content for our very specific audience.
Sounds like a plan, and I think there's a lot we can learn from this, even beyond just creating audio summaries. It's really about honing those legal analysis and communication skills.
100%. Okay, so the first thing that jumps out at me about this LexPlug guidance is how well organized it is.
Right? It's like they've anticipated all our questions.
Seriously, so they've got these clear sections like key points to cover, narrative flow, even areas requiring careful explanation, which I love because it shows they're really thinking about how to make this stuff stick.
And that's key, right? You can throw a bunch of legal jargon at someone, but if they don't actually understand it, what's the point?
Totally. So right off the bat, they emphasize that our target audience is law students, which means we need to strike that balance between being comprehensive but not overly technical.
Yeah, no one wants to listen to a dry recitation of the entire case verbatim.
No, for sure. And they even suggest a specific format. They say a conversational dialogue between two hosts would be ideal, which makes sense. It's more engaging and approachable.
Way more. I mean, think about how you study with your classmates. It's all about bouncing ideas off each other, asking questions, making connections.
Yeah, exactly. And they even suggest aiming for a specific length, 15 to 20 minutes, which forces you to be concise and get to the heart of the matter.
Love that because it mirrors the time constraints law students are always facing. Got to squeeze in that case review between classes and outlining.
Always. Okay, so let's get into the meat of this thing, shall we?
Let's do it.
So the case they use as an example is Main v. Delaney Miller Auto Co. It's a classic pedestrian accident case, and the guidance starts with a really helpful case overview just to set the stage.
The who, what, when, where, why?
Exactly. So we've got Walter Mann, the plaintiff. He's suing Delaney Miller Auto Company and their employee, Bart Scanlon.
And just for our listeners not familiar with legal terminology, when we say plaintiffs, we're talking about the person who's bringing the lawsuit, the one who's claiming they were harmed.
Exactly. Thanks for clarifying that. And the type of case this is falls under tort law. Specifically, we're dealing with negligence and this idea of vicarious liability.
Ah, yes, vicarious liability, the concept that makes employers sweat a little.
Right, because it means they could be held responsible for the actions of their employees.
Exactly. So in this case, a big question is going to be whether Delaney Miller is liable for what Scanlon did.
And adding another layer of complexity, we've also got this issue of contributory negligence.
Meaning Maine, the plaintiff, might have also been negligent in some way that contributed to his own injuries.
Right, so it's not just a straightforward who's at fault situation. There could be fault on both sides.
And that's where things get really interesting from a legal perspective.
For sure. And the guidance also tells us the procedural posture of the case. So it went to trial. A jury actually found in favor of Maine, but then the defendants appealed the verdict.
Okay, so there were definitely some legal issues that the trial court might not have gotten quite right, hence the appeal.
Right. So now that we've got the basic overview, let's dig into the specifics of what actually happened that night.
The nitty-gritty details.
So the accident took place late at night, 11:55 p.m. to be exact, and the location was Market Street.
And I'm assuming that this was in a busy area.
Yeah, I mean, the details aren't super specific, but given that it's called Market Street, we can probably assume it wasn't some deserted country road.
Makes sense. And this is important because the location and time of day can play a role in determining negligence. Was it well lit, or are there a lot of pedestrians around, things like that.
Good point. And another crucial detail is that Maine was crossing the street outside of a designated crosswalk.
Jaywalking.
Right, which immediately raises that question of contributory negligence. I mean, he was breaking a traffic law.
Exactly. But as we'll see later, just because he was jaywalking doesn't automatically mean he loses the case.
Right, it's not that simple. And then we get into the conflicting accounts of what actually happened. Maine says he looked both ways, didn't see any cars coming, and then stepped into the street.
So he's claiming the exercise some level of caution.
Right, but then Scanlon, the driver, says Maine just suddenly darted out into the road without warning.
Classic he said, she said situation.
Totally, and it's up to the jury to decide whose version of events they believe more.
Which is one of the reasons juries are so important. They get to weigh the credibility of witnesses and sift through conflicting evidence.
Absolutely, and then there's this added wrinkle about Scanlon's reason for being out that night.
Oh yeah, that dual purpose thing.
So he had gone out for a picnic, which was a personal activity.
Okay, so not work related.
Right, but he was also tasked with checking on some company vehicles, which was part of his job.
Ah, so that's where the vicarious liability question gets really tricky. Was he acting as an employee at the time of the accident, even though he was also doing something personal?
Exactly, and that's going to be a key issue the court has to grapple with.
Makes you wonder if he ticked off checking those cars on his to-do list before or after the picnic.
Right, like was he on his way home from the picnic or just heading out to do his work duties? Who knows?
The case details might not be that granular, but you can bet the lawyers were digging into that timeline.
Oh, for sure. Okay, so now let's move on to those core legal issues that the court had to address.
The legal battleground.
So the guidance lays out three main issues, and these are the things that any good Lex Plug episode would need to explain clearly.
Got to break it down for the law students.
Exactly. So issue number one was Scanlon acting within the scope of his employment at the time of the accident.
Which goes back to that vicarious liability question we talked about.
Right. Is Delaney Miller responsible for Scanlon's actions, even though he was also on a personal outing?
And I bet this hinges on that whole dual purpose thing, what he was doing right at the moment of the accident.
For sure. Then issue number two was managed contributory negligent by crossing outside the crosswalk.
So was he partially to blame for his own injuries?
Exactly. And this gets into some really interesting legal concepts like prima facie negligence and proximate cause.
We'll definitely have to unpack those.
Oh, yeah. And then the third issue is a bit of a procedural one. It was whether the trial court gave the jury proper instructions on the last clear chance doctrine.
The last clear chance doctrine. One of those tricky exceptions to contributory negligence.
And it sounds like the appellate court thought the trial court messed this up.
Which is a big deal because faulty jury instructions can be grounds for an appeal.
Exactly. So let's go through each of these issues one by one and see what the court ultimately decided.
Sounds good. I'm ready to channel my inner appellate judge.
All right. So first up, scope of employment.
The million-dollar question for Delaney Miller.
Right. So the guidance says the court found that the jury was justified in considering Scanlon's post-picnic check of company cars as part of his job.
So even though he was out for personal reasons, that work-related task could still bring his actions within the scope of his employment?
Exactly. And it seems like the court focused on this idea of the right to control.
Meaning, did Delaney Miller have the authority to control what Scanlon was doing even during that picnic car check hybrid outing?
Right. And it's not about whether they specifically told him to go have a picnic first. It's more about their general right to control his work duties.
Like, did they set his schedule? Did they give him specific instructions about checking the vehicles? Was he technically on call? Things like that.
Exactly. And it sounds like in this case, the court concluded that Delaney Miller did have enough control over Scanlon's actions to potentially be held liable.
So that's a big win for Maine, at least on that issue.
For sure. Okay. Now let's move on to contributory negligence.
So did Maine's jaywalking seal his fate?
Well, not quite remember how we talked about that ordinance violation being prima facie negligence?
Yeah, like an initial red flag.
Exactly. So the fact that Maine crossed outside the crosswalk creates this presumption that he was negligent, but it's not a game over.
It's rebuttable, right?
Exactly. Think of it like a legal presumption that can be challenged with other evidence.
Okay, I'm starting to see the nuance here.
And the key here is proximate cause, meaning was men's negligence the actual cause of the accident or was it something else?
Like maybe Scanlon was speeding or not paying attention.
Exactly. And the court said that's for the jury to decide. The ordinance violation doesn't automatically mean Maine was the proximate cause.
So the jury has to weigh all the evidence and figure out if men's jaywalking was a substantial factor in causing his injuries.
Right. And this is a really important point for law students to grasp because it shows that just because you break a rule doesn't mean you're automatically liable for everything that happens.
It's all about causation and the specific facts of the case.
Absolutely. Okay, now onto the last clear chance doctrine.
The plot twist.
Right. So this is where things get a little complicated. The trial court gave the jury instructions on this doctrine, but the appellate court said those instructions were incorrect.
And that's why they reversed the original verdict in favor of Ben?
Exactly. So the guidance emphasizes that this doctrine is essentially an exception to contributory negligence. It gives a negligent plaintiff a chance to still recover damages if certain conditions are met.
So even if Maine was negligent by jaywalking, he might still have a case if the last clear chance doctrine applies.
Exactly, and the guidance breaks down the three key elements that have to be present for this doctrine to kick in.
Like a three-part test.
Right, so first, the defendant has to have known or should have known about the plaintiff's dangerous situation.
Like if Scanlon saw Maine in the road and had time to react.
Second, the defendant has to have had enough time to avoid the accident.
So if Scanlon had time to brake or swerve but didn't.
Right, and then here's the crucial third element. The plaintiff has to have been oblivious to the danger they were in.
So Maine has to have been unaware that he was about to get hit.
Exactly, and the guidance really emphasizes that this obliviousness element is often overlooked or misinterpreted.
It's not just about the defendant having a chance to avoid the accident. It's also about the plaintiff being helpless to avoid it themselves because they're not even aware of the danger.
Right, and it sounds like the trial court's instructions to the jury didn't properly explain this nuance, which is why the appellate court reversed the decision.
So it's a really important distinction, and it shows how even seemingly small errors in jury instructions can have huge consequences.
Totally. Okay, so those are the three main legal issues. Now let's take a step back and look at the bigger picture.
The so what?
Exactly. So the guidance has a section on critical legal concept where they kind of summarize the key takeaways from Min.
This is where we connect the dots for our law student listeners.
Right, so first up, vicarious liability. They reiterate that it's all about holding an employer liable for the actions of their employee, but only if those actions fall within the scope of employment.
Which, as we saw, can get pretty complicated, especially when you have situations like Scanlon's dual-purpose trip.
Exactly. And then they revisit that idea of prima facie versus contributory negligence.
So remember, prima facie negligence is like that initial presumption based on something like violating a law or ordinance.
Right, but it's not the end of the story. You can still argue that your actions weren't the proximate cause of the harm.
And contributory negligence is the broader principle that if you were also negligent, your ability to recover damages might be reduced or even completely barred.
Right, it's all about apportioning fault.
And then, of course, they emphasize that three-part test for the last clear chance doctrine with that extra reminder about the plaintiff's obliviousness.
Which they say is a common pitfall, even for experienced legal professionals.
Easy to miss those subtle but important details.
Totally. Okay, so now that we've covered the legal concepts, let's talk about how this would all actually translate into an audio summary.
Time to put on our LexPlug producer hats.
So the guidance provides a suggested narrative flow, which is basically a roadmap for structuring the episode.
I'm intrigued. How would they hook our listeners right from the start?
They recommend opening with something catchy, like framing it as a classic torts showdown, you know, to pique interest.
Oh, I like that it's like setting the stage for a legal drama.
Exactly. And then they say we should lay out the facts and procedural history in a clear and concise way.
Highlighting those conflicting accounts of the accident and Scanlon's dual-purpose trip.
Right, because those are the elements that make this case so interesting. And then they suggest dedicating a good chunk of time to explaining each of those three key legal issues.
Scope of employment, contributory negligence, and last clear chance.
Right, and for each issue they recommend going beyond just stating the rule and actually explaining the reasoning behind it.
Like, why does the right to control matter for vicarious liability? Or what are the policy reasons behind the last clear chance doctrine?
Exactly, and they even suggest using analogies and real-world examples to illustrate the concepts.
Which is so important for making this stuff relatable to law students who are still grappling with these ideas.
Totally. For example, they suggest using an analogy like a delivery driver making a personal detour to explain the scope of employment issue. You know, does the company's control extend to those personal detours?
That's a great one because it's something everyone can relate to.
Right. And for contributory negligence, they recommend using something simple like someone jaywalking but narrowly avoiding an accident to show that not all rule violations automatically equal proximate cause.
Again, super relatable and helps to clarify that nuanced distinction.
Exactly. And then for last clear chance, they suggest using contrasting scenarios to show when the doctrine would apply and when it wouldn't.
Like if Maine had clearly seen the car coming but still walked into the street, versus if he was completely distracted and unaware of the danger.
Right. Those kinds of examples really help to solidify the understanding of the rule.
Makes it less abstract and more concrete.
Absolutely. And then after explaining legal issues, they recommend wrapping up with a section on significance and key takeaways.
So what does Maine teach us about tort law in general?
Exactly. Like, what are the implications for employer liability? Or how does this case clarify the nuances of the last clear chance doctrine?
And they even suggest ending with a thought-provoking question to leave the listener pondering.
Something like, how far should employer liability extend for actions taken outside of work hours? you know, to spark further discussion.
Love that it keeps the conversation going even after the episode ends.
Totally. All right. So now let's talk about some of those specific areas that the guidance flags as potentially tricky for law students.
Where we anticipate those confused looks.
So first up, they reiterate the importance of explaining prima facie negligence using clear and simple language.
Maybe using that analogy of a presumption that can be overcome with evidence.
Right, because prima facie is one of those terms that sounds way fancier than it actually is.
Law school is full of those.
Isn't it? And then they emphasize clarifying the difference between proximate cause and just general causation.
Which can be a stumbling block for a lot of students.
Right, so they suggest maybe saying something like, Maine crossing outside the crosswalk might not have been the legal cause of the accident if Spanlin had plenty of time to see him and avoid hitting him regardless.
Oh, so it's not just about whether Maine's actions play a role in the accident, it's about whether they were the primary and foreseeable cause.
Exactly, and then they once again highlight the importance of using contrasting examples to illustrate the obliviousness requirement for the last clear chance doctrine.
Because that third element is so crucial and often misunderstood.
Absolutely. And they even remind us that even seasoned lawyers can sometimes trip up on this stuff. So it's not just a law student thing.
Makes you feel a little less alone in your confusion.
Right. And finally, the guidance touches on the desired tone for the audio summary.
How do we make this both informative and engaging?
So they say conversational but precise, which is a delicate balance.
Yeah, you don't want to be too casual, but you also don't want to sound like a textbook.
Exactly. And they suggest using rhetorical questions to keep the listener actively engaged.
Like, what do you think would have happened if?
Right. And they also emphasize acknowledging that certain concepts like vicarious liability can be tricky to grasp at first.
Which helps to build rapport with the listener and make them feel less intimidated.
Totally, because we've all been there, right?
Oh yeah, those early days of law school when every new concept felt like a foreign language.
For sure. So overall, it seems like the key to creating a successful audio summary for law students is really understanding your audience.
Knowing what they're struggling with, what will keep them engaged, and how to break down complex ideas into digestible chunks.
Exactly. And Maine v. Delaney Miller is a perfect example of how to do that.
It's got those juicy factual details, the conflicting accounts, the tricky legal issues. It's basically law school in a nutshell.
Right. And this LexPlug guidance really provides a fantastic framework for taking any case and turning it into an engaging and informative audio experience.
And it's not just about creating a podcast episode. It's about honing those legal analysis and communication skills, which are essential for any lawyer.
Couldn't agree more so. As we wrap up here, I want to leave our listeners with a little thought experiment. Imagine you're trying to explain a particularly complicated case to a classmate who loves learning by listening. How would you apply the principles we discussed today to create a concise and engaging audio summary for them?
What key points would you highlight? What analogies or examples would you use? How would you structure the information to make it flow logically and keep them hooked?
Give it a try and see what you come up with, because the ability to explain legal concepts clearly and effectively is a skill that will serve you well throughout your legal career.
Couldn't have said it better myself. Thanks for diving deep with us.
Always a pleasure.
Until next time.